TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Common Future Under Climate Change. Professor Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber. At 3 a.m. today, April 21st, news services in California announced the death of Pope Francis. Among the many memories of his extraordinary life, his encyclical on climate change, Laudato Si, came to my mind. Only 9 days ago, Pope Francis had announced the celebration of the 10th anniversary of Laudato Si, later this year in September. Now we need to create the conditions for peace to prevent the destruction of our home without his help. But Laudato Si has dual roots. Maybe for the first time in the history of papal encyclicals, Pope Francis invited scientists to create the text, foremost among them Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber. You will hear precious excerpts from his presentation inside the Vatican in June 2015 at the end of this program. But here first is Schellnhuber in front of a secular audience in Paris in a TUC radio program that I produced in 2015. In the early days of July 2015, over 100 countries sent 2,000 delegates to Paris. They discussed the physical, economic, and social aspects of climate change. That was in preparation of the COP21 climate conference that will convene in Paris in December 2015. Some prominent conference speakers said that we need to end the carbon-based economy that relies on oil, gas, and coal, and we have to do it within the next 2 decades to remain under 2 degrees warming. When I was going for hours through the enormous amount of material from those 2,000 speakers, I came across a voice that caught my full attention by someone hardly ever heard on U.S. media. Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber spoke in one of the closing panels, and what he said expressed the urgency and the scale of the problem we have to solve. Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, a.k.a. John Schellnhuber, most recently came to world attention as a leading scientific advisor to Pope Francis. He was chosen to be one among only 4 speakers at the presentation of the Pope's Global Warming Encyclical. That was on June 17, 2015. And you will hear part of Schellnhuber's presentation at the Vatican at the end of this program. Part of the credentials that brought Schellnhuber to the attention of the Pope may have included his doctorate degree in theoretical physics and his role as chief government advisor on climate and related issues during Germany's EU Council presidency and G8 presidency. He's currently the leading climate advisor to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, whom he has known since at least 1995. That was during her term as Minister for the Environment. Skipping over many other credentials that you can look up on the website of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, PIK. Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber has been director of that well-respected institute since he founded it in 1992. Here are Schellnhuber's unscripted comments at the conference on Our Common Future Under Climate Change, held in Paris in July 2015.
Let me first make an observation. In a sense, it's surrealistic that in the talks before, we heard about the fact that we will run out of our carbon budget globally in the next 15 to 30 years. And at the same time, we are sitting here in a well-air-conditioned hall in Paris. It's a beautiful day outside. and we feel absolutely happy and comfortable, obviously, of being here. This is strange, but it's very human. So let me make a few remarks now. First thing is, from what has been said during this conference, it is a very bad idea to go beyond the 2 degrees line. So let's take this as the reference line. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it? So my conclusion is the following. In order to stay below 2 or even 3 degrees centigrade, we need to have something really disruptive happening over the next 2 or 3 decades. I would call it the induced implosion of the carbon economy over the next 20 or 30 years. Otherwise, we have not the slightest chance of avoiding dangerous, maybe disastrous climate change. And of course, there are many recipes formulated here by Joe Stiglitz, for example. Yes, it would be wonderful to have an enforced carbon price by a coalition of the willing or working, hopefully the global community. Kevin Anderson gave this response in a sense where he said we need a radical change in the consumption patterns. So if we cannot change the supply side on energy immediately, we may be able to change the demand side very rapidly. You can overnight decide not to fly to any place anymore. You do not have to create a new industry for that. You can just make that decision. So there are other suggestions being made, of course. In the end, I think what could bring about such a deep transformation of the modern industrial metabolism is a combination of factors. Actually, what I think is the best analogy to that is the abolition of slavery. You have a few other examples, and I studied that quite extensively. And it was a combination of 3 factors, actually, that brought about the transformation in the first decades of the 19th century. So quite rapidly, actually, in the end. And it was, I call it the 3D dynamics. So the first was disaster. Revolts of slaves in Jamaica, in Haiti, quite gruesome things that happened, which created a lot of fear among the plutocracy, whatever you call it. The second was discovery, second D, namely the Industrial Revolution. You were able to replace slavery by, and the work of slaves by just machines. But the third, and I think this was the most compelling part of the story, was decency, namely the moral issue. In the end, I think it's a moral decision, a decision based on moral, whether we want to get this transformation going over the next decades or not. And actually, this is about a global social movement. And this global social movement is actually happening right now. And I'll give you just a few examples on that. One of the persons who is part of it is Pope Francis. So I had the tremendous honor to help present the encyclical a few weeks ago. I gave the first PowerPoint presentation in the Vatican for 2,000 years, I guess. So that was a world first. But it went out quite well. It was a major event. And the Pope afterwards told me, he wants to be part of his social movement. We had just last week 36 Nobel laureates in Mainau, in Germany, signed a declaration on climate change. Very powerful, very bold. And we have the divestment movement, which I fully support, by the way. It simply means, do we want to be part individually of an economy that destroys the world? Or do we want to be part of an economy that is protecting creation in the end? And everybody can join in. So let me come back and conclude my first remarks. 3D, again, The 3D strategy is that you should be aware of the disasters, not slave revolts, but devastating natural disasters, and nature will just imply that on us. The typhoons over the Philippines are just the beginning of this development. Much more is in store, clearly. So nature will just speak to us in very rude words. Discovery. We have all the means, actually, to change the energy system. The solar cell was discovered at Bell Labs in the 1950s. Why don't we use it? Why don't we deploy it all over the world? But the last thing, really, I think, is decency. So we all have to make a choice, and it's a moral choice. And the choice is, do you want to be part of that generation that finally screwed up the planet for the next 1,000 years? I don't think we should make that choice.
You are listening to the closing panels of the Paris Conference on Our Common Future Under Climate Change. Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber is professor for theoretical physics at the University of Potsdam. In the Q&A section, Schellnhuber addressed the purpose of the meeting, the preparation of the upcoming COP21 session in Paris. He points to new word in the language of international climate agreements, decarbonization.
Since we are here in Paris and everybody is staring at November, December, of course, COP21, so of course we have to address the issue of governance in general. We had a very successful, I guess, at least from the perspective of the climate G7 meeting in Germany, with a declaration which was beyond expectation, actually. And for the first time, a word appeared in such a document, namely decarbonization. If you go to all the other documents, you will not find it, not at that level. And this is what, I guess, what COP21 could deliver. I'm not expecting a cap and trade scheme global with fair allocation of shares and so on. We know we are beyond the Copenhagen illusion now. But what I expect is a strong narrative, telling people the age of carbon is over. We know there is just one future. The future will be a decarbonized one. And a second message has to come across, which is, it will not the poor of the world who will pay for this transition. That is ridiculous. This is ludicrous, really. And this is what I would also like to refer to what Yuval Sokona said and also Joe Stiglitz. The promises of the modern age based on fossil fuels have never been fulfilled. We still have, I think, 2 billion people at a $2 per day level, which is crazy, in spite of all the oil and gas and coal we have taken out of the ground. That's what I included in my presentation in Rome at the Vatican was, well, you can call it the tale of the 2 billions, namely the top billion and the bottom billion. So the bottom billion people do not contribute at all to climate change. It's maybe 1% of emissions or something like that. They may double their emissions or even quadruple them. The climate will not be destabilized. It's all sitting in the top billion. So either behavioral change, reinvestment, whatever, at the top billion level will save the day in the end. And I think this message has to come loud and clear in Paris.
Just a short question. How do you see the role of the research community in creating this narrative and helping in the changes?
Start because I'm sort of part of the scientific community, and some of the slides you have seen before I helped to create with the IPCC. Now I'm really asking myself whether the IPCC format is not an outdated one. So this is a provocation, of course, and you can shout at me. But do we really want to know in a more certain way about the climate sensitivity? Do we really need another 7 or 14 years in order to make the evidence even more compelling, going from 95% certainty to 97, 98, 99? You can calculate when we will have reached 100% certainty, namely never. One can, of course, proceed, and one should do it, maybe with a more efficient format, having shorter reports every 2 or 3 years. I think this is really related to what will happen in Paris and after Paris, namely regarding the review of the evidence. I would rather see that there will be emerging an institution based on solid science which will precisely contextualize all political actions coming out, hopefully from Paris and later events, in terms of the evidence. I think that is what science has to deliver. And science actually, I think, has also to transgress the red line of becoming policy recommending. It's always used this term prescriptive. Nobody loves prescription, of course. So this is a psychological trick. I'm actually part of a body recommending the German government what to do about climate change. And this is even my mission. It's written down. And I have to do it, and people are expecting it from me. So I think a dual development would be the best possible science should contribute to reviewing climate action over the next 10, 20 years, and it has to be disruptive. But I also think the scientists who know absolutely enough about the risk we face should be willing to make clear recommendations now.
That was Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, professor for theoretical physics at the University of Potsdam and founder and director of the renowned Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. I mentioned at the top of the program that Schellnhuber was an advisor to Pope Francis' encyclical on climate change. He was the only scientist who had been invited to speak at the presentation. Here's the beginning of his speech at the Vatican.
Allora, professore, a lei la parola. Grazie di essere qua.
Yeah, thank you very much, Your Eminences, Your Excellences, ladies and gentlemen. I'm deeply grateful that I'm here and able to add to the choir the scientific voice, if you like. I guess it's also a world first that presentation of an encyclical will be accompanied by a PowerPoint presentation. So I have to rely on modern technology, so may God help me. I studied the encyclical, the text very carefully, and it is also very unique in the sense that it brings together two strong powers in the world and strong forces in the world, namely on the one hand faith and moral, and on the other hand reason and ingenuity, because we are faced, as my predecessors have said, with a dual crisis on this planet. It's an environmental crisis, certainly, but it's also a social crisis. And these two things together pose a tremendous challenge, and only, I guess, if faith and reason work together, hand in hand, we can overcome this crisis. So, yes, nature is very complex and the climate system is very complex, but to come to grips slowly with that, and I tried to show you a little bit how we explore the nature of the climate system. 74,000 years ago, I was on Sumatra, the Toba volcano eruption, and it almost extinguished humanity. From genetic analysis, we can demonstrate now that around that time, only a few hundred Homo sapiens had survived, just a few hundred. But humanity overcame that crisis, and so here we go, and you see these tremendous fluctuations persisting until a miracle happened. And this is what we call the Holocene. This is the last 11,000 years, a period of tremendous climate stability. This is the time when the climate allowed us, the creation allowed us, to invent agriculture. It was called the Neolithic Revolution. And that's where the human enterprise really started to become dominant on Earth, actually. Now, two factors produce more or less, in a quintessential way, these fluctuations in this behavior of the climate, according to science. So the first factor is that the Earth is going around the Sun, as we know, but the orbit can have different shapes. It can be almost circular. It can be like more elliptic, for example. And that is dominated by the forces of gravitation, so the gravitational pull of the planets Jupiter and so on. And also the axis of the Earth may be tilted more or less. And it may precess, like a toy of a children. So these three things are purely based on the laws of physics. Now, there is another factor. By the way, it was Milutovic Milankovic who, in 1941, published his major work on the orbital forces on the climate. The second factor is what we call the greenhouse effect. And it was first calculated even earlier by Svante Arrhenius, the Swedish Nobel laureate, and he published this in 1896. These are the two factors. And in almost eternal competition, CO2 and the orbital forces have shaped the development of the climate. Until very recently, when humankind has interfered in a strong way and is releasing CO2 through burning fossil fuels. What I show you now is billions of data put together in a different history of the world. It's not a history by battles and kings and so on. It's the history of burning fossil fuels. I call it the sea story of human civilization. And what you see there is the emissions coming from various pixels on the globe, from the various regions. But you see that it all started in England. You see the color of England. And now the Industrial Revolution enters the continent. So Germany, Poland, France, Belgium, and so on. Now we are moving towards the Napoleonic Wars, Waterloo, 200 years ago, 1815. And you see how in old Europe, the emissions keep on spreading. But the rest of the planet is black. There are no emissions at all, not in Africa, not in Latin America, not in Australia, and so on. Now, slowly, we are moving towards what we call the Victorian Age, so where has been a lot of acceleration of technology, science, and so on. And you see, actually, that on the continent, the second carbon power is being established, that is Germany. In a sense, competing with the UK, with the British Empire here. And now you see other places of the world becoming carbon intensive, and we move towards a major competition between the carbon powers. And this is on the eve of the First World War, actually. So you see United States of America are becoming the third carbon power, but the First World War can be seen as the clash between the carbon powers, United Kingdom and Germany. Now the First World War starts, and now it ends. It was decided by the third carbon power on Earth, the United States. While now in the Far East, you see Japan becoming a carbon power as well. And you see other patches of color appearing in South Africa and Australia throughout the British Empire. Now we are in the midst of the Second World War already. And after the Second World War, what happens is what we call the Great Acceleration, or you also call it globalization, where based on fossil fuels, you have transport systems spanning the planet. And now you see that the entire planet is trying to catch up by sucking up carbon in the form of oil, gas, and coal. So Japan is fully developed as a carbon power now. And now towards 1990, a new power comes into the play, and that is China. These are cumulative emissions, by the way, added up over the centuries. And you see that China is turning red now within just 2 decades, and is catching up with old Europe within just 2 decades. Now, this is the world map today, what you see. It's still very patchy. And the question is, of course, is the aim of the human enterprise that the whole planet will turn red, the same color everywhere? We could not afford to do that because we would transgress all the planetary boundaries. But the question is now, who has benefited from this major development? This is an ad I have picked up in the London Underground. And it says that today the 85 richest people on Earth have the same wealth as the poorer half of humanity. So we balance the income and the wealth of 3.5 billion people. This is not true, actually, because today it's only 60 people. Within the last 2 years, the rich have become much richer, but the poor haven't caught up in any way. Now, is this a fair distribution of wealth? Now, there is another myth which I would like to shatter, namely that there are too many people on Earth and they are destroying the environment. So the many poor people on Earth with their emissions are jeopardizing the human enterprise. This is utterly wrong. The bottom billion doesn't contribute anything to greenhouse gas emissions. It's all done by the upper billions. So it's not poverty that destroys the environment. It is wealth, consumption, and waste. And this is reflected in an encyclical.
That was part of the speech by Hans Joachim Schellnhuber, professor for theoretical physics at the University of Potsdam, given at the Vatican. That's when the text of the Pope's encyclical on climate change was released on June 17, 2015. You can see the rest of the talk on the Vatican YouTube channel. Search for On the Care of Our Common Home. Before that, you heard comments from the July 2015 conference in Paris, Our Common Future Under Climate Change. And here are my thanks to you for having received again the radio program that I produced 10 years ago. It's in honor of Pope Francis, who died yesterday. His encyclical on climate change, Laudato Si, and Professor John Schellnhuber's contribution. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.